Hello, you're listening to the Global Music Show. This will broadcast on September 24th, 2008. Today, our guest is Professor Mark Driscoll from Asia Studies. He teaches Japanese and anything else I should add.
And East Asian Studies, mainly Japanese modernism, but also I'm teaching a class right now on Japanese pop culture. Oh. We're actually listening to some of the music we'll be hearing today.
That will be interesting. And my name is Stanton. I'll be your host this week. Let's go ahead and get started. We're going to play some, I've always mispronounced this, Keiji Haino.
That's okay, Haino Keiji. Haino Keiji, yeah, he's one of the most interesting noise musicians in Japan today, but based in Tokyo. And right now, believe it or not, is the house musician for this Bangaru Lounge, which is in Roppongi. It's really a fantastic kind of club space that's kind of this avant jazz place. But they also have noise musicians that play a couple nights a week. So we're going to listen to some of his stuff first.
Right, I'll go ahead and put that on. This is Global Music Show.
Thank you.
All right, so we're listening to some Hainu Keiji. So you were talking earlier about Japanese noise musicians. It's a pretty big deal. In America especially, there's a lot of famous Japanese noise musicians like Mertz Bell and the Boredoms and Masona and artists like that. Can you give me like a brief rundown about why this developed in Japan specifically and some features of it?
Stan, sure, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about kind of noise music, kind of the beginnings when it got big in the late 70s, early 80s, it was really focused in kind of two places, Germany and Japan. There's a huge scene that really began kind of with psychedelic rock in the late 60s, but really took off in the 70s and 80s. And people are always curious about why it kind of began in Germany. At least the most important kind of artists were German and Japanese. And it really has a lot to do with kind of World War II history and what happened after that, how both of those places were kind of really destroyed. But in Japan, a lot of the most famous noise musicians, industrial musicians, especially this person, Akita Masami, I don't know if you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. He's arguably the most influential now. He's from Osaka, so Osaka was just complete, like Tokyo was very much destroyed, and people were very poor until the mid-60s. So some of the earliest Japanese noise musicians really, literally couldn't afford instruments. So ended up kind of playing, even though we think about Japan as a super high-tech kind of paradise or dystopia, depending on what we think about technology, for a long time until the mid-70s, and especially outside of Tokyo, people were super, super poor, and very similar things happened in Germany. So people kind of played their environment in really interesting ways, and it was also a way to talk about, to kind of... put yourself in your body kind of into your kind of specific environment. Mm-hmm. So that's how Akita himself, who's also a theorist and a philosopher, writes about kind of his past, and he writes about the early kind of noise scene in Osaka, which is a much grittier industrial city than Tokyo is, and which is why the Boredoms and some of the bands that you just mentioned come from this place, which is arguably the biggest, the densest amount of noise musicians in the world per capita reside in this city in Japan.
Akita is, he's the one who recorded this, Mertz Bell, has his name, right?
That's right, absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that because Mertz Bell, the name comes from a German art movement.
That's
so
right.
So there's a distinct interplay between the two there.
Yeah, even in American kind of noise music, you can see the influences of Germany and Japan, yeah.
And the other thing I want to, you mentioned early 70s psychedelic rock in Japan. I don't know if you brought any with you today.
I didn't bring any today, psychedelic rock. I mean, it's kind of, it's a big, big, huge thing. It's almost like bigger than J-pop is, like as far as sales and stuff like that. So I didn't bring any psychedelic rock today.
Because that's sort of getting a more Americans starting to listen to it. Especially artists like Ayuri's Danube. Do you think that the popularity of that came also from this post-war environment in Japan? The sort of building up from nothing sort of thing, like you were discussing with Noise, that they had to start over again. So do you think that made Japan more susceptible to embrace those kind of forms, those kind of extreme and avant-garde musical forms?
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, you know, obviously psychedelic, when you're getting into kind of something that's more concerned with alternative consciousness, drugs, stuff like that, you're going to get into something different. You're going to get into more consumer society. But that obviously did happen in Japan as well, especially after the 1964 Olympics, mm-hmm. when the economy took off, called the First Asian Miracle. And there was a lot more things to do, and there's a lot more leisure time for people to drop out, and you know, you can see kind of dropout consciousness kind of embodied in these long psychedelic rock jams, right? Where you really don't have to be at work or you don't have to do anything at a certain time. But psychedelic rock is really, I think, socio-historically more connected to the early 70s, where you know, very similar phenomenon. And Japan becomes a first world country, so you really, there's no need to separate it from the way that people were living their lives and kind of the forms of political expression that they were concerned with kind of articulating in the late 60s and early 70s. It's very similar then, mainly in Tokyo. So you see the difference between Osaka, which is where kind of noise music is centered in Tokyo, which is kind of the center for psychedelic rock. Mm-hmm. Tokyo definitely took off and became a global city like London or New York or San Francisco much quicker than these other places did.
I bring this up particularly because a lot of discussion of Heino Keiji places him sort of between noise and psychedelic rock because he plays the guitar. And so I just think it's interesting that those are two very popular in Japan. You know, I hadn't really thought about the historical context for it, but I'm going to just turn this back up for a little bit, and
sure.
then we'll move on to the next just a few minutes. Just saw him, this artist in concert. Why don't you tell me what that was like?
Yeah, no, I just saw him at this really, really interesting club in Tokyo, one of the most outrageous clubs I've ever been to, which has these kind of pillows on the floor. It's a big flat space, and it has these kind of big pillows on the floor. And kind of the music and things kind of happen around the people kind of sit in the middle. So it's supposed to be this decentered concept. Heino will sometimes, like I said, he's the house musician at this place.
Right.
So he will do all kinds of things. He will take advantage of the space, and when he plays with other people, people will be situated in different corners of the room to try to get different kind of acoustic experiences happening. Right. So anyway, yeah.
So he plays in the middle of the room, and the people are around him?
He will often do that, right? Right, and he's into virtual audio stuff now, where he'll try to, I mean, depending on kind of the sound stuff he has, he'll try to project, try to get the listeners to not figure out where sound is coming from, which part of the room, which amp is coming from. So anyway.
I guess I'm going to go ahead and cue up the next song. This next, it's going to be a big change of pace, I guess. Pizzicato 5.
Yeah, Pizzicato 5. You probably know a lot about them, probably the listeners do, but Pizzicato 5 was definitely groundbreaking. I mean, I'm only interested in some of these things because we're taught to think about kind of pop culture or pop music or kind of progressive music in pretty much Eurocentric terms, not thinking about Japanese or Korean or Chinese kind of artists as innovating anything. It's just copying kind of things that originate, I don't know, in San Francisco, London, or New York, places like that. But Pizzicato 5 definitely should be credited with introducing a number of different dance music forms to New York dance clubs. And people like Madonna were listening to them way before they were listening to her. So it's, you know, it's interesting to think about influences or sometimes synchronicities. Different things are happening in different places. Similar things are happening in different places. But oftentimes, especially when we're talking about Japan in the early 80s, where it really does become more developed and kind of more advanced than kind of these Euro-American kind of urban sites, certain kind of Japanese artists become kind of globally influential. And Pizzicato 5 is definitely one of those.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and stop.
Yep.
ことを一緒に3時間も待っていたのよ私のこと一緒にトリッキーのミニスカートでトリッキーみたいなポーズでトリッキーのミニスカートでトリッキーみたいに痩せた みたいに喋ったテレビのボリューム下げて私嘘みたいな声で
listen to Pizzicato 5 right now. And that was a. This is from. What is this album?
This is called. This is 5x5. This is Pizzicato 5's first release outside of East Asia. Mm-hmm. And it included some very early songs. I mean, the one we just heard was called Twiggy Twiggy, which was first recorded in 1988.
Wow.
So you can hear some of the sounds. It became really popular in New York-based and Chicago-based dance music.
Yeah.
In some sense, much later. But what allowed them to do that is that both of the keyboard players were actually designers for Korg.
Ah.
So for a couple of years, they were literally a year and a half or 2 years ahead of kind of sampler technology.
Wow.
And stuff like
so
that.
So yeah, they I thought so. That song we just heard was mostly samplers that they.
Yeah, absolutely, all samplers. Yeah.
Oh, really interesting. Right. Yeah, it's two men and a woman. The woman
right.
sings in the movie.
That's
interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Where do you know where the name comes from?
It's kind of funny. You know, I don't know where it comes from. It comes from. There's rumors that. They're big Warhol fans. They were big kind of pop art fans. And actually the singer, whose name I've forgotten, I'm sorry about that, studied art. was an artist and a designer before she got into music. But people say it was Pizzicato 5 was the, when Warhol was in, he was in Tokyo actually twice, and one of his expressions one time when he was out doing drugs somewhere was, he kept saying this phrase, Pizzicato 5. There were rumors in Japanese art circles that that's where the name comes from.
That's a pretty good story. Yeah. They're from the 80s and 90s. Are they still a band now?
No. They broke up 6 or 7 years ago. They're all doing solo projects now, but they were all recording for all 15 years or so. 15, 16 years or so, yeah.
So it would be fair to say like noise music sort of represents the dark side of post-war Japan, and Pizzicato 5 sort of represents the post-boom sort of thing.
No doubt about it.
Brightness, yeah. And because if you listen to this, it's really bright and happy and very clean sounding.
Absolutely. No, you're right. It's the other side of kind of the, in some sense, the Japanese miracle. This is the light, creamy kind of public side of it. Mm-hmm. Kind of noise music is like, in some sense, who or what has been excluded by these kind of economic miracles. But Pizzicato 5 is just definitely trying to show that kind of miracle, that face to the world. Absolutely, yeah.
So I think it's interesting because they both the Boredoms and Pizzicato 5 were probably the first two big Japanese artists to be known inside Japan, and they both reached consciousness about the same time.
That's right.
In the 90s, so
right. I mean, they were also influenced by, I'm sure you've heard of, listeners have heard of, maybe not of this band, Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That this solo artist who's a very, very important producer right now called Sakamoto Ryuichi, who's also an actor, was that was his group, and he was kind of a mentor for the keyboardist in Pizzicato 5. And then he was disappointed, actually, in the direction that the band took, because they became too much more, way too pop for him, and not politically or kind of ecologically focused enough for Sakamoto.
Again, I noticed there, are they singing in English in this?
They're singing like most J-pop bands will sing in a combination of Japanese and English. So most Japanese will understand some English but not be able to speak any. And so they kind of started this trend, actually, where you will sing some lines in English and then kind of two-thirds of the main kind of lyrical focus will be in Japanese, and English words will be thrown in for emphasis or kind of decoration.
Right, so I guess we should move on to the next track. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, the next track is this leftist group that actually, for their jobs, they run Food Not Bombs in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And kind of on the weekends, it's a political kind of, they're anarchists, and they have a group called The Happening. And they were just kind of one of the headline acts at the G8. There was a protest against the G8, which occurred in Japan, in Hokkaido, in northern Japan this year. And The Happening were one of the three or four groups that kind of organized kind of the political art around the protests against the G8.
Okay.
This is called Barricade. Barricade. Okay. I saw them actually perform this while they were riding in a truck at a protest in Tokyo a couple years ago, the first time I heard this song. So I guess you can hear it. Why so free? Justice, you say. Yeah, no, this is this group is really interesting, but they were involved when the Japanese military was deployed abroad to go to Iraq in April 2003. It was the first time since World War II when it was the first time since 1945 when the Japanese army had fought outside of Japan. So so there were huge protests in Tokyo around this, and actually from a British group called Reclaim the Streets, a bunch of younger Japanese artists and musicians started these demonstration called street raids. Mm-hmm. So they would illegally rent a truck and have bands and kind of DJs and kind of organize these protests in the streets of Tokyo that were a lot of fun. So people would, they'd encourage this Tokyo, especially the shopping district, there's just tons of people out all the time. Mm-hmm. So they would try to get people into the streets and dance behind the trucks. Huh. And then they would hand information out to the mainly young kind of consumers, basically, about kind of, well, I don't know, Japanese kind of contemporary capitalism and kind of exploitation of its workers and the connection to Japanese military support for the U.S. War in the Middle East. It's just very interesting. This group is very influential in kind of the street where this new protest phenomenon called street raves quickly caught on, and people were doing it in Korea and outside of Tokyo and Osaka and other places.
Sapporo. Yeah, because Japan sort of has a reputation as a very consumer society, so it's an interesting. That's the other part of it being, I guess, once again, we're seeing light and dark, you know, except for they're talking about it. So they're from Tokyo?
Yeah, they're all Tokyo-based. They're all no work people, or slow life people, which means they refuse to work, and they live collectively, and they accept handouts for kind of the food that they make for the homeless and poor people and stuff like that. Yeah.
So are they? It's like an anarchist collective.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. They're the kind of musical front for the anarchist collective. One of the anarchist collectives that is pretty influential in Tokyo right now. Tokyo, super expensive city, the second most expensive city in the world. So a lot of young people can't afford their own places or to. Yeah, that was called The Barricade, and this is from a compilation, I can't tell you the name of it, but it's a compilation against the G8
well,
that
can,
was happening.
You can imply it's called, you know, F.
Oh, yeah, yeah. F-ing the G8 2008 right. In Hokkaido, Japan, I guess.
What are we going to listen to next?
We're going to listen to one of the most influential and one of the first global trip-hop groups called Museum of Plate. Museum of Plate really started, they didn't start recording until, it's actually a woman solo act, and they were recording really in the early 90s, so some people consider them kind of a real pioneer, and kind of you'll hear kind of the sound that's coming out, but just a woman, Nakano Yuko, who is a pianist, really. But then into the early 90s, got into tape loops and sampling and stuff like that, and kind of came up with a very interesting sound.
Interesting.
So we'll hear some stuff from her first CD, which the title of it is Practical Symphony No. 5.
Okay. Let me go ahead and... Okay. We just heard their Museum of Plates.
Right. Museum of Plate.
Plate, sorry.
Right. Yeah, that's all right. Yeah.
And that was a woman pianist who, I guess there's not much more really to say about that, except for it's another example, like Pizzicato 5, I guess, about Japanese artists being on the forefront of new movements, because with her and trip pop, I guess.
Right, we'll listen to some, maybe we'll listen to another track later, something much more techno focused. Okay. But
so we're going back to the earlier compilation, Against the G8.
You know, maybe can we listen to this for just like another minute?
Okay, yeah, I can just turn it back up and and after this, I'll just go ahead and play the next track. So.
Great. Okay, great. Yeah.
Spirit.
a cut from this Korean anarchist, actually, artist named goes by the name of Dopehead, and he writes Dopehead using Chinese characters, which are used in Korean and Japanese, and it's very interesting. So he's devised a way to use Chinese characters as they're vocalized in Korean mm-hmm. to spell Dopehead in English. And he appears often. There's a big anarchist DIY movement in Seoul. It's also a zero work movement protesting kind of, oh, I don't know, the harsh conditions. I mean, people, you have to work 50, 60 hours a week in these middle class jobs, kind of like here, to make ends meet in these really expensive cities like Seoul or Tokyo. So the anarchists kind of have really interesting events together, and they always try to support each other. But this guy, Dopehead, is kind of like Haino Keiji. He will he'll do shows in many different formats, kind of techno stuff, or sometimes just with acoustic guitar. But he's known for carrying his acoustic guitar to protests. And I was just with him a couple weeks ago, I guess now 2 months ago, in Hokkaido, and he was actually in Hokkaido, Japan, protesting the G8, and he was with his signature guitar there. He always walks around in demonstrations with his guitar strumming along. So he's a very interesting character.
That was an interesting song. I was expecting more punk because of the first track, but he had that weird noise in the background. So Japan and Korea have a troubled history, but there's still, you know, I guess I'm asking what the connections are like on the level like that, like on the anarchist level and on the subculture level, how connected are they?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Japanese cultural products were illegal in Korea until just 8 or 9 years ago. Hmm. So technically, you weren't allowed to sell or purchase Japanese music. So all avant-garde Japanese forms like noise music and psychedelic stuff, these things literally had to be smuggled in because of the colonial past. I mean, Korea was all of Korea, North and South, before it was North and South Korea, was a colony of Japan from 1905 to the end of World War II. And there's a lot of harsh feelings still between Koreans and Japanese. But obviously, anarchists have bonds over political issues that transcend nation-state forms. So some of the more political peace movements in Japan and Korea have actually formed alliances well before kind of the new corporate capitalist free trade treaties that are being signed by Japan and Korea right now.
That's an interesting point that I thought about earlier. We were talking about, for example, Pizzicato 5, who we're going to play again next, exporting to America. Japan has this very troubled relationships with its neighboring countries due to pre-World War II and World War II actions. How do the other Asian countries, does that affect the way they deal with Japanese culture? For example, how does this music get exported to places like Korea and Philippines and China?
Well, no, it's a really interesting question. I mean, specialists of this don't really know the answer to that. But, I mean, from my experience living in Shanghai and Beijing recently, it's like a lot of things. I mean, because it's dangerous and naughty, a lot of Chinese young people and kind of subculture types will be attracted to Japanese pop culture and Japanese subculture for that very reason. So much so that the kind of alternative kind of DIY cultures or like alternative commercial cultures in the big cities in China are really dominated by Japanese cultural forms. Yeah. So the similar kind of thing in Korea, because the governments have outlawed or tried to marginalize Japanese consumer culture, oftentimes people will be drawn to them for that very reason. So, but I mean, in some sense, because of the Japan was the West really in East Asia since 1895, from the first Sino-Japanese War of 1895, and Japan was the first modern non-Western imperialist power. The Japanese kind of military and kind of economic elites kind of dominated East and Southeast Asia until the end of World War II. And that's, in fact, what World War II was about. Who was going to control the Asia-Pacific? Was it going to be Japan or was it going to be the U.S.? So that was, at least in my estimation, why World War II happened. And also because of that, because of Japan's economic takeoff in the early 1960s, really right after the Tokyo Olympics of 1964,
Sorry for that. When you're listening later, when we recorded this, we had a little bit of technical difficulties, but we're back now. And I guess we were talking about the rise of New Japan and the way it affected the way Japanese culture is dispersed across Asia. And did you have anything else you want to add about that?
Yes. I mean, like I was saying, I mean, it's interesting because Japan was the West in East and Southeast Asia, in the West in the sense where it was seen by other Asians as the kind of most advanced, technologically, industrially developed part of Asia. And Japanese military and economic elites took advantage of that to control large swaths of Asia in the 1920s and 1930s. And then after World War II, after Japan's crushing defeat, quickly they allied with the U.S. in the Cold War. So Japan kind of became the model capitalist country in East Asia that was supposed to show other Asians that if you became a liberal capitalist democracy like Japan supposedly was in 1947 and 1948, you too could be a consumer capitalist nation. So Japan, as a result of U.S. aid and as a result of other things, as a result of the high development that they'd already enjoyed in the 1920s and 30s, became yet again the kind of imperial Tokyo, especially became the site of the most advanced urban and technological forms throughout Asia. So we have a second wave of Japanese kind of influence in Asia that began after the Tokyo Olympics in 1964, which is when kind of Japanese economic development took off and phrases like Japan Inc. and stuff like that became widely circulated in Anglophone countries. So as a result of that wave of Japanese consumer products into Southeast Asia and East Asia, Japanese kind of subcultural and artistic forms also followed that. And became, even in countries that had outlawed them, like Korea and China, they became very influential, and artists and alternative types really preferred to listen and consume Japanese kind of underground and subcultural forms than Western forms. So Japanese noise music, trip-hop, things like that became huge influences on artists in Korea and China and in Thailand and Indonesia, mm-hmm. kind of before kind of European artists. And obviously kind of these artists identified as Asians with some of these influential Japanese figures.
Mm-hmm. So now we're going to go back and listen to some more Pizzicato 5. Does that have anything to connect them to the discussion we just had about? Like how, for example, are they perceived in Asia and in Japan? Pizzicato 5.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's with some of these avant-garde, so-called J-pop groups, they would have become popular by playing in some of the former colonial cities that Japanese imperialists really built, like Taipei. Taiwan was a Japanese colony from 1895, and Pizzicato 5 really got their start. They became really big by appealing to a Taiwanese and a Hong Kong audience.
Interesting.
Kind of before they became big outside of East Asia and Euro-America. So Hong Kong, again, another place that developed very quickly, and the Hong Kong boom started in the 1970s and 1980s, also has its own independent film scene. I mean, most of the listeners have heard of Hong Kong cinema. But also there's an interesting music scene and noise scene in Hong Kong as well.
Interesting, I didn't know that.
Very much influenced by the Japanese artists. And Pizzicato 5 and the J-pop group would make a lot of money touring in Hong Kong and Taiwan, and then in these days in South Korea and China. There's and some of the biggest Chinese kind of pop culture groups and singers definitely have been influenced by the Japanese artists. And so you see these waves of the temporality of influences starting first in Tokyo and then kind of moving out to some of the more peripheral Japanese cities before they go to Taipei, Hong Kong, and now China. So you see that movement similar to the ways that we see it kind of in Euro-America.
Okay. Well, I'm going to play this song and then we'll just listen to it.
What's your name?
Maki Noya.
Your birthday?
March 12th.
What's your star sign?
Pisces.
Your blood type?
A.
What type of men do you like?
Happy Japanese or shy foreigner.
What type don't you like?
Cheap guys.
Who are your current lovers?
I have one.
What's your favorite food?
Raw food.
What food don't you like?
Food that makes me fat.
What's your favorite fashion?
Fashion that's cute, gorgeous, and in bad taste.
What fashion don't you like?
My uniform when I went to high school.
What's your hobby?
Barbie dolls.
What were you doing last Sunday?
I went to a mage shrine.
When did you wake up this morning?
11:30 a.m.
Who's your favorite fashion designer?
Betsy Johnson.
Favorite lipstick?
Elizabeth Arden.
Foundation?
Max Factor.
Perfume?
Coco.
What color hair do you wish you were born with?
Red.
Are you a good cook?
No.
What food do you cook best?
Tomato-based stew.
What do you wear when you sleep?
Pajamas.
What did you eat when you woke up this morning?
Oxygen.
What's your favorite word?
Dating.
What words don't you like?
Hard work, patience, and courage.
What's your favorite flower?
Tulips.
Favorite color?
Sky blue, black, and violet.
What's your favorite season?
Spring.
Where do you most want to go now?
The Southern Islands.
What's your job?
Singing.
Do you like your work?
Yes, I do.
Do you like your songs?
Yes.
Do you like your voice?
Yes.
What is your dream of the future?
I don't know.
What's the happiest thing about your life?
I was born.
How about the saddest thing?
It's too sad. I can't tell you.
What part of yourself do you like best?
Nothing.
What part of yourself don't you like?
My body is too thin.
What part of your personality do you like best?
I am easygoing.
What part of your personality don't you like?
I am easygoing.
What is your habit?
I mess up my room.
When was your first love?
In fifth grade.
What kind of guy was he?
A guy who had long hair that I found in the library.
What type of guy is your current lover?
A mysterious person who makes me laugh.
What do you expect from him?
It's a secret.
So that's Marcus Cut 5. The name of that track is, what is the name of that track?
What did you dream last night?
The name of that track is, it's gotta be, Baby. Oh, This Year's Girl. Yeah, sorry. Right. It's based on a Jean-Luc Godard movie. Right. So they're extremely concerned with kind of underground kind of culture. But the Godard movie is masculine, feminine. There's a famous interview scene. Actually, there's a number of interview scenes in Godard's movies, and it's based on a number of those.
Right. I think that's interesting. Just to bring this all together, you listened to the song earlier. Pizzicato 5, like we were saying, seems to be the bright and bubbly side of, but there's still all these underground influences. And so, for example, Godard, and they went to art school apparently. So, I just think that's an interesting sort of juxtaposition for the band and a lot of Japanese. Well, I guess this is the end. Thank you so much for being our guest this week on the Global Music Show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Professor Mark Driscoll, in case you missed the beginning, professor in Asian Studies. Do you have any last words you'd like to add?
No, I think we're going to play some Akita Masami music after this. And no, it's been a lot of fun. And just want to remind people of, again, some musical influences. Often, I mean, when I was in school, you're always taught to think about people wanting to copy kind of, I don't know, U.S. kind of musical forms and stuff like that. But oftentimes the influence actually goes the other way. And many of those times, kind of the other influences, especially from non-Western kind of places, aren't acknowledged or aren't kind of registered. So just to let people, give people a heads up about that, and say thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for coming. Yeah. And yeah, like you said, we're going to listen to a Mertzbel track. This is from his album 1930. Speaking of actually fascism and what have you, the name of the other tracks on this album are Mukin, Degradation of Tapes, and Iron Glass Blocks and White Lights, to bring it all full circle. We began with a Japanese track, and we're going to end with one. So thank you for listening to the Global Music Show. This will be broadcast on September 24th, so I hope you're listening to it then. Thank you. Mm-hmm.